Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. And
speed is our subject.
You beat me to it.
Actually,
what this whole next segment is about.
See, I had it in my bones.
Just to set it up, I got this idea from my friend Andrew Zolli, who is a fantastic writer, wrote the book Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. We were at a diner. I was telling him about this show, and he says, you should do something about the stock market. And I was like, I'm the last person should do something about the stock market. Yeah. He's like, no. Forget everything you think you know about the stock market.
Most of us, when we think about stock markets, if you just close your eyes and you think about the financial world, what you imagine is a bunch of people in a room and they're all wearing funny colored jackets and they're shouting at each other and waving bits of paper,
yeah.
Right?
70 bit.
This kind of raucous...
Montana 23!
People screaming, trying to figure out what a price is. And we have this sort of iconography, this cultural iconography of how the financial system works that is in large part completely divorced from reality.
Because he told me, here's my first surprise, that somewhere between 50 and
70 plus percent
of all the trades that happen on what we think of as Wall Street
are not executed by a human being. As the result of a human decision, they're actually executed by an algorithm at a speed, rate, and scale that is beyond our comprehension.
So I decided I would try and comprehend this new world that he was describing. And since this is a subject matter that generally makes me frightened, frankly, I decided to call up David Kestenbaum from Planet Money.
Hey, Jet.
Hello.
The David Kestenbaum. Okay.
Indeed.
There could be more than one.
There probably are on Twitter. In any case, it did not click for either of us just how fast, how inhumanly fast trading had gotten until we visited this firm called TradeWorks.
Hi.
Hey.
David.
Nice to meet you, David.
So we go into this little building in New Jersey. It looks like it's a startup or something. And this guy says hello.
My name's Mike Beller. I'm the chief technology officer of TradeWorks.
And Mike
over here
sat us down at this computer, opened up this little program that logs
exactly what is going on at the market at insanely specific times.
You could pick a stock. We could look at Yahoo, for example. We can literally pick some time of day that we're interested in.
So what time is this?
So this is at 11:35, 26.979 seconds.
Okay. Really?
And in fact, that's not enough precision for us because we really deal in microseconds.
That would be millionths of a second.
So we have another way of measuring time, which is the number of microseconds since midnight of the previous day.
Can you read that 417 number?
Sure. 41,729,979,559 microseconds since midnight.
Wow.
So do you always have lunch at like 2,305,000?
No, that'd be really early.
How many trades do you do in a day?
I think it depends a lot. A high-frequency trader might do 1,000 trades in a minute.
It's about that tempo.
But it's kind of very bursty.
Now, what happens during those bursts is a bit of a mystery.
It's very hard to see what's going on.
Often, says Andrew, it's the computers testing the market.
Testing to see if they can find a nibble on the other side.
They'll fire out a bunch of buy and sell orders, and then when another computer bites on one, they'll quickly cancel the ones that didn't stick.
Didn't want to do that.
And they're doing this on a microsecond basis. Buy.
Nope, sorry.
Sell.
Nope.
Buy.
Nope.
Sell.
Nope.
Sell again.
Nope, forget about that.
Buy. Nah.
And they create huge volumes of transactions that just disappear into the ether.
There are some computer algorithms, he says, whose whole job is to
combat other algorithms.
Fake them out.
For example, we just...
very good example. It happened about a month ago in Kraft.
That's Eric Hunsander. He tracks high-frequency trading for the firm Nanex. Kraft, like Kraft cheese, Kraft?
Yes.
He says what they saw was this algorithm jump into the market, buy up a bunch of Kraft, which
jammed the price up.
Which allowed that algorithm
to sell at much higher prices to the other algorithms. And we calculated out it cost them $200,000 to push the price up, but they were able to sell about $900,000 of stock, netting a gain of over $500,000.
In a matter of seconds. Now, to put that in context, back in the day, you know, 20 years ago, when the humans still ran the trading pits, according to this guy,
I'm Larry Tabb, founder and CEO of the Tabb Group.
The average time that it took to execute a trade was
around 11, 12 seconds back then.
And when you ask people, how did we get from 11 or 12 seconds to
41,729,979,559 microseconds since midnight?
Phrases like that. The answer is kind of surprising. But I'll just start with the obvious part, at least the part that's obvious to people who work in finance. It wasn't obvious to me. But a basic law of the market is that the fastest person will usually win.
There's always a benefit.
That's Andrew again.
To getting information faster than the other guy.
Absolutely. This has been going on since Julius Reuters used carrier pigeons
to send a bunch of stock quotes.
Faster than a guy on a horseback.
That was in the 1850s.
Here's a more modern example. Say the latest job numbers come out.
U.S. employers added 227,000 jobs in February.
If those numbers are good, that means the stock market is going to go up. So if you can get the numbers and rush to the market before anyone else gets there and buy the stock before it goes up, you could make a lot of money, right?
On the, you know, buy low, sell high principle.
Basic law of getting rich.
But when the markets turned electronic, which began to happen in the early 90s, this basic law created a situation that was totally bananas.
What do you mean?
So imagine it's the year 2000. You've got this market in New York. It's electronic. It's basically just a building on Broad Street near Wall Street with a giant computer inside of it that's matching buyers and sellers. And you have a bunch of traders in different parts of the country that are connected to this market, to this building. And some of them are using automated trading bots. And one day, this guy Dave Cummings, who is in Kansas, notices that his robot keeps getting beat. Like when it would send a trade to New York, like say a buy order, often, right as that buy order was about to get to New York, some other robot would swoop in, get there first, and snatch up the trade. And it occurs to this guy Dave, wait a second. Is it 'cause I'm in Kansas? If the other guy's closer to New York, then his cable would be shorter, so I need to move to New York.
No, because we're talking about the speed of light.
Well, close to the speed of light.
Obviously, it's because he's in Kansas.
What do you mean, obviously?
Because the speed of light is like a foot a nanosecond. You're going to get your ass kicked if you're in Kansas.
I don't even, how, do you know this for a fact?
Yeah, it's a foot a nanosecond.
It's a foot a nanosecond.
It takes a billionth of a second to go a foot. It's 3 × 10⁻¹.
Why do you act like this is something everybody knows?
I know this because when I was in physics, like if I needed to delay a signal by a nanosecond, by a billionth of a second, I just added an extra foot of cable.
And then really?
Did you really do that?
Yeah, because the proton antiproton would collide and then it would create a muon that would go out. And you only wanted to measure, you wanted to filter out all the junk. So you knew when it was going to arrive roughly. So you had a little like window. It had to arrive within the window, but you had to get the timing of the window right. So it meant like adding a delay, and we just would add cable. That was the easiest way to add
delay. So you would literally go get some from cable and just splice it in.
Not splice. They're LIMO connectors.
Oh, they're LIMO connectors. Of course.
Here's another way to think about it. Like say the time it takes for information to get from Kansas to New York is something like this. Did you hear that?
I did.
First beep is when it leaves Kansas. Second beep is when it arrives in New York.
Yes.
I actually slowed that down just a bit so we can hear it better. But the point is, that is fast, but there's still a little space in there between the beeps, which is the travel time.
Very, very little space.
But even if these signals are traveling at millions of miles an hour, close to the speed of light, if somebody is a few hundred miles closer to New York than you, and they leave at the same time as you, well, then it's going to be like, you hear that? But it.
Yeah.
That beep in the middle is some other dude beating you by a few milliseconds.
These little differences matter?
They're trying to get in and out super fast. And maybe each trade they're only making
a fraction of a penny.
That's it, says Andrew.
But if you're making a fraction of a penny, millisecond after millisecond after millisecond,
can add up.
Right.
But you have to be able to react really fast. So when this guy in Kansas decided to move his robot to New York to get closer to the big market computer...
When this happened...
It started kind of a land grab.
There was a real estate bubble around some of these buildings. Because people were trying to buy physical real estate next to the exchanges so that the cables that they would run into the exchanges would be just a few feet shorter than the other guy.
Wait a second. So does this mean like if I'm like one stop up on the elevator and you're two stops up that I have the second floor advantage? I mean, how far do you do this?
Theoretically, yeah. I mean, that's what it means. But I don't know how far this real estate jockeying got, because pretty early on, the people who run the market stepped in and they were like, okay, this could get crazy. So they told the machine traders, okay, you want to be close to us? Fine. Pay us some money. We'll let you come inside.
Inside our box?
Inside the mothership.
Is there like some room where all these computers are keeping each other company now?
Oh, yes, there is. Huh.
If you visit the New York Stock Exchange now, which we did.
So this is where are we heading
after
now?
Going through months of security checks, what you see
in the match itself is where the trades actually happen.
Amazing.
Ooh.
Wow. Wow.
So this is, what, a 20,000 square foot hall?
This is Ian Jack. He's head of infrastructure at the New York Stock Exchange. He showed us around.
With a number of rows of racks for customer equipment.
In 2006, the New York Stock Exchange opened up this room. It's the size of three football fields filled with nothing but...
rows and rows of servers, different specifications.
So these are owned by banks, hedge funds, brokers?
Yep, a whole number of financial institutions.
Are these things trading right now?
Absolutely.
Each of these computers, and there were close to 10,000 in the room, give or take, were at that moment analyzing the market, making a decision as to whether to buy or sell, sending that decision over a cable into an adjacent room where it gets bought or sold.
Yeah.
No people involved.
If you stood still for a few seconds, the lights went out. They automatically went off if nothing moved, because the assumption was there were not going to be people there.
And the whole idea of this place, says Ian?
The whole premise is a level playing field. So any firm can come in here and they'll have the same access as anyone else.
And to make sure of that, this is my favorite part.
Every single rack within this facility has the same length of cabling to get to the network points at the end.
Exactly the same length?
Exactly the same.
Everybody gets the same length cabling, whether you're 1 foot away from the network hub or 1,000 feet away, you get the same length.
I'm sure they send synchronized test pulses from both your trading computer and Jad's trading computer, and they make sure they arrive exactly at the same moment.
I like to imagine they have a guy with a tape measurer.
That's the guy you bribe. That's the guy.
Anyhow, you would think that since all machines can now be inside the exchange, literally inside the market building, that the speed race would be over, right?
Yep.
No. Actually, it only gets worse. Because the place we visited, the New York Stock Exchange, that's just one market of many. I didn't know this, but apparently when all trading went electronic, the markets fragmented.
It used to be that the trade stocks, there was the New York Stock Exchange, and then there was NASDAQ.
Really just those two markets, says Larry.
Now there are 13 regulated exchanges. There are roughly 50 what they call dark pools in the marketplace.
Those are non-public, basically.
Yeah.
So you got these 60-some-odd different markets, and that's created all these different speed races between them.
Yeah.
Here's a super basic example I talked about with Andrew. In Chicago, you've got this thing called the commodities market.
Commodities are basic goods like corn, oil, soybeans.
Zinc.
Pork. That's what they do in Chicago. Here in New York, we do equities.
An equity is a share of a company.
So you have basic goods in Chicago, stocks of companies in New York.
Those are different kinds of things, but they're connected to each other.
Right? You know, because like take oil, which is traded in Chicago. A lot of companies depend on oil, and they're traded in New York. So say oil goes up in Chicago, you can pretty much bet that right after that, a company like Exxon is going to go up in New York. But it won't be instantaneous.
Right, because information has a speed.
Back in the days of the telegraph, as we learned, it took a quarter second. About that long to get from New York to Chicago. Now, with fiber optic cables, about 15 milliseconds.
I love that. I had no idea you could actually hear the time difference.
That one, I think, is pretty accurate. 15 milliseconds. But say you're in Chicago, oil goes up, you know it. And you can get to New York in 14 milliseconds. Well, you've got 1 millisecond where you know the future. You know exactly what's going to happen. You're not even betting at this point. This is easy money.
So what happened over time was a race of people to provide the straightest fiber line between Chicago and New York.
That's Mike Beller again from TradeWorks. He's part of this race.
A couple of years ago, a company came along.
Not his, unfortunately.
And spent some eight-figure sum to cut a straighter fiber line between those two points. And
according to some reports, they blew through a mountain to do it.
They did a lot. And where the state of the art for communication lines at the time between the two locations was about 15 and a half milliseconds. They came along and they made that state of the art 13.3 milliseconds.
A savings of about 1 millisecond each way.
Which is just it's just an eon.
It's a thousandth of a second you're talking about. That's not an eon.
Well, it's an eon when your computer system is able to make a decision in 10 microseconds, which ours are.
That's 10 times faster.
So your computer's like, I could do this so fast, but I'm just waiting for the news from Chicago.
So a lot of us were sitting around thinking, what can we do about this?
Turns out there was a way to get from Chicago to New York a little faster because the speed of light through air, it's a little faster than when you're going through a fiber optic cable. And so what they're doing now is they're building a series of towers so they can beam the signal through the air from one tower to the next tower to the next tower all the way from Chicago to New York.
So,
and that would bring the travel time down to about?
In the neighborhood of around 8.5 milliseconds.
Instead. So you're going from 13 to 8.5?
Yeah.
That would be going from this to this. I mean, come on.
That's a lot of potential savings.
I can totally hear the difference.
Is it helping? Are we fast enough now? Can we stop?
Here's the thing.
That's Manoj Narang, the CEO of TradeWorks. He joined us for part of the interview, and he told us, actually, we would love to stop this arms race.
Yeah, absolutely. The arms race is a huge drain on resources.
But he says we just can't.
As it stands, when a new technology comes out that makes it possible to be faster, if I don't adopt it and my competitors do, I will lose out to them. I have to do it.
And looking at Manoj in particular, you could kind of tell that this part of the job...
It's just like the plumbing.
Yeah, it just kind of makes him weary.
Yeah.
No, I couldn't care less.
Why not just call a truce and everyone say, we're not going to try and go faster. We're already way faster than any human can think. It's fast enough. We're going to stop.
Why not call a truce? Because there's a such thing in game theory called prisoner's dilemma.
And someone will cheat, you're saying, basically.
Yeah. You can't put a gun to everyone's head and force them to abide by this truce.
Even though we'd all be better off if you could.
Well, who would be better off?
And here Manoj told us, look, even though this speed race sucks for us, it's actually helping you. Because on a basic level, anytime you replace a human with a computer, things are going to get faster, they're going to get cheaper. And now that the machines are competing, getting cheaper still. In 1992, it would have cost you about $100 to trade 1,000 shares. Now, $10.
So yes, humans have been completely supplanted when it comes to short-term trading. And humans who complain about that are being disingenuous, okay? They have not been displaced by anything other than the fact that they can't compete.
You seem like you've had to, you seem defensive.
Well, just because I can explain the economics of the business doesn't make me defensive.
That also sounded defensive.
If Manoj did sound defensive, it's only because he and Mike and everyone in their industry have had to answer a lot of questions over the past few years about where all this speed is taking us. And those questions always come back to one particular day, May 6, 2010, when things got a little fruity.
We hadn't had a down day in a long while. The market had been slowly creeping up for quite a while. And
that's Eric Hunsander again, the analyst who's been tracking high-frequency trading. He says that day, even though things had been going really well...
That day had started off down pretty hard.
Which made some sense because there was bad news coming out of Athens, people were nervous. But then, at a very specific moment, 2:42 in the afternoon...
14:42 and 44 seconds...
All hell breaks loose.
Okay, Neil, let me just interrupt for a second, because this market is dropping precipitously. It just went negative 500. It is now negative 560.
Seven even offer. Six halves are trading here now. Six evens are trading.
As you can see it on the screen, the Dow is losing about 653 points. Now Dow is down 707 points.
Eight evens are trading here now. 79s are trading.
Boom, there it goes. Look at this market. It continues to slide.
Look at it. 835.
This is the widest we have seen it in years.
Now it's down 900.
Wow. Almost 1,000 points.
This will blow people out in a big way like you won't believe.
Cancel all orders. Down 1,000 points. Cancel all orders.
At 2:45 and 27 seconds, an emergency circuit breaker shuts off.
For 5 seconds. And that was the end of the slide. When it went out and stopped for 5 seconds, that was the bottom of the market.
1,000 points down, several hundred billion dollars vanished.
2.5 minutes.
Equally weird, when trading started again, the markets bounced right back up.
About 2.5 minutes later, it was 600 points higher than the bottom.
It was like, phoom, boing. Now, these kind of swings had happened before, but never that fast. And the speed is one thing. Arguably, what's more troubling is that we still, 2.5 years later, don't really know what happened. I mean, the SEC investigated for months, released this giant 84-page report where they essentially blamed the whole thing on one bad algorithm, that this guy in New York was trying to sell a bunch of stocks, told his computer to do it. His computer just did it a little too aggressively.
No, that's not how it went down at all.
Eric doesn't agree. He thinks what happened is that all the high-frequency computers just clogged the network.
Really, the cause of the flash crash was system overload.
Because he says a basic feature of these computer algorithms is when they detect that the network is slow, they pull out.
You know, one of the maxims on the street is, when in doubt, stay out or pull out.
And so if you've got this one computer selling a ton of stock and no computers left to buy, that creates a vacuum.
Now, there were people who argued that high-frequency trading had actually made the situation better.
Because, you know, Andrew says the markets did bounce back.
Right up to the top.
The computers self-corrected, perhaps.
But the point is, nobody had any idea.
And that's what gets him. That we're in a situation now where when things go wrong, they go wrong in the blink of an eye. And then it takes us years to figure out what happened?
The question that comes up is, have we crossed some kind of Rubicon where we've passed into a realm where the complexity, speed, the volume of all of this stuff makes it no longer human readable? We just don't know what the system is doing and can't, in principle, find out when things go wrong.
Big thanks to David Kestenbaum for joining me. If you don't listen to NPR's Planet Money, you definitely should. Definitely. Check them out at npr.org/money. And thanks to Chris Berube, who carried a heavy load with the reporting on this segment. And also, sound artist Ben Rubin, who lent us the sound of those floor traders.